I'll try to be very brief as much as I can. We were kind of encouraged to give an introductory talk to more or less describe the system, say what the state of the knowledge or ignorance is in the electron glasses. And so I'll start right away. I just would like to thank the Institute for hosting this program, which hopefully is going to lead to a better understanding. So let me first start with some very introductory remarks and one basic problem in all the glasses, not only this glass, is the fact that the glasses are a non-ergodic system. So that already ergodic, basically to a physicist, mathematician, that's a slightly different definition, but to a physicist, means that if you have some observable quantity, let's say O, the time average of O, is the same as the ensemble average of O. Where an ensemble, of course, is just some kind of Gedanken, a huge set of identical systems. And so the condition for that is that you have a sufficiently quick traversal of the system through the phase space, or the relevant part of the phase space, and in many cases this is true, but when you have very slow transition rates of the order of an experiment, of the duration of an experiment or so, it is not true. So the consequence is that since the established statistical mechanics is based on this equality, on the ergodic condition, is that there is no really established theory to deal with systems which are non-ergodic, like glasses. And the reason that and usually this is what you measure, right? This is the experiment. And this is theory. So we have a hard time connecting experiment with theory. So now let me ask the question, what is a glass in the first place? So glass, usually one thinks of glass as the conventional glass, like window glass, for example, and the technology for that existed now for 1,000 years, started in Mesopotamia somewhere, about a few 1,000 years BC, but the attempt to understand microscopically glasses is only about 50 years old. The origin of it is the interest in disordered systems, which started about 50 years ago, mainly due to Anderson and to Mott. And so that's when people started getting interested in glasses. So now, to a physicist, there is a whole menagerie of glasses, not just the usual glass, but there is vortex glass, and there is spin glass, and there is electron glass, and there is polymer glass, and a number of others. And they all are called glasses because they have some properties which are quite similar to the conventional glass. So the basic ingredients for all the glasses are disorder and interaction. They all have those two properties, and the hallmark, as far as observation goes, are very slow relaxation, non-exponential, very slow relaxation, and what is called aging. Now, aging is not used the same way by everybody, but I think the most fundamental way to use it is the violation of time homogeneity, which means basically that if you look at some experiment, if you start an experiment at time t zero, and you look at something at time t, then no matter when you start the experiment, the result of the experiment is only a function of t minus t zero. That is, we all understand that as a normal kind of thing, but now this condition is violated in glasses, and I'll show you soon how.
Excuse me? Question?
Yes, certainly.
If you require a breakdown of agudicity, then cannot you imagine a non-interacting particles with a landscape of many minima, such that the transition from one minimum to another will be exponentially large, in which case the system does not equilibrate, but there is no interaction. I mean, you mentioned that interaction is a necessary condition for glass.
Well, interaction is, a necessary condition for memory and for certain things in a glass, not necessarily for slow interaction. Slow response. And I'll just give you an example for that soon enough. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if you have a slow relaxation to equilibrium, that you also have that many different minima. I think the fact that you have many different minima, the physical reason for that is, for example, in the electron glass, is that particles try to avoid each other, and so it's advantageous for them, same with spins or whatever, it's advantageous for them to move several at the same time. So the low energy excitations are multi-electron excitations. And the minima in phase space in the traditional picture, which doesn't necessarily hold for everything, is that the distance in phase space is given by the number of particles that you excite. And so I think the structure of having many minima in phase space has to do with interaction inherently, because it is a result of the fact that you want to move many particles together. And that, of course, you want to do when you have interaction. So I think that the many minima in phase space is a necessary condition for that is interaction. At least I can't think of a system without interaction where you would have that. Okay, so now, as I said, the slow interaction and the aging, which are hallmarks of a glass, are direct consequences of the non-ergodicity. I mean, the slow relaxation automatically, because that's why it is non-ergodic, the violation of the of the homogeneity of time comes from the fact that when you have the slow relaxation and the state of the internal state of the system is changing very slowly, and it is the internal state of the system which also influences the what you see, the observable that you see at some time t. And so the result doesn't depend on the function of t minus t zero, but also on the internal state of the system when you begin the experiment. And so that is the physical reason, I think, for the violation of the homogeneity of time. And so I'll give you some examples. First of all, how do well, so the first slide is already here. How does one measure slow relaxation and aging? So the usual experiment, the procedure is usually to cool the system to a certain temperature, but that doesn't matter. You let it try to equilibrate for as long as you can make a feasible experiment, maybe of the order of a day or a few days, till it is as close to equilibrium as you can hope for. Then you change the external condition somehow, which will excite the system at some time, let's say T0, and then the system will try to relax to a new equilibrium, which is appropriate to the new external conditions. And so normally what happens in, let's say, crystals or usual materials is that the response is extremely quick, of the order maybe of 10 to the minus 10 seconds or something like that. But in a glass, and this is just an example, you see that the relaxation is extremely slow and non-exponential. So this is the usual way to just look at slow relaxation. The way you usually measure aging is you start the experiment exactly the same way, but you stop the external force after some time TW. Okay, and then you think of the experiment as beginning after you switch off the external force. So the first part that you see here is just the first part of the relaxation that I showed before in the previous slide. But now what's interesting is what happens after that. And so here is an example of an experiment as a function of time, a response as a function of time, after time t equals zero. And you can see that it happens to be on an electron glass, but other glasses exhibit something similar. You can see very clearly that it doesn't depend only on T, but it also depends on TW. Because changing TW changes the history, the internal state of the system, if you wish. That's one way to change the history of the system. The state of TW is going to depend at T equals zero here, it's going to depend on TW. All right, so now let's get, this is generally for glasses. Now let's get to the electron glass. And what is specifically an electron glass? So basically an electron glass is a system of electrons in a very highly disordered medium, and interaction becoming important between the electrons. So they're both disorder and interaction. Now, you can ask yourself the question, why electron is an extremely light particle? How can it be so slow that it form a glass? I mean, one of the things in a glass is that the particles are extremely slow, that they relax extremely slowly. Transition rates are very slow. So how can an electron glass actually, how can a system of electrons become glassy? And some people don't even believe that there is such a thing as an electron glass, but there are several reasons. So the first reason is that it lives in a disordered system, and if it's sufficiently disordered with Anderson localization, and then the propagation of the electron is by hopping. And now, by Mott's variable range hopping process, if you lower the temperature, then there are fewer and fewer states in which can hop. So it has to hop for very long distances, and that slows down the electrons because the transition rates in a certain model which has to do with electron-phonon interaction are given by something roughly like nu phonon times e to the minus some delta over kT, of course. If it jumps up, if it jumps down, you don't have that factor, but the important factor is here, minus 2 R over the localization radius. That comes from Fermi's golden rule and a certain approximation for the electron-phonon interaction. So as you lower the temperature and allow fewer and fewer localized states to conduct, this becomes extremely slow, and so you can have a very slow process with only sufficiently large disorder and low temperature. But the interaction adds another factor to it, another slowing down, and that is the Coulomb gap that, compared to not having interaction, the density of states at the Fermi level has to become much smaller. Okay, and so as far as one particle transitions go, at a certain temperature, this becomes even smaller, much smaller, because you have fewer sites near the Fermi level where conduction occurs. There is a way around it to make an excitation, a collective excitation of several electrons, but there, instead of having this kind of transition rate, this now becomes e to the minus 2 sigma over r over xi. Okay, and so now you have to slow it down with the many particle transition. You have to slow it down even more because now we have a sum of distances.
But you have combinatorial factor.
I'm sorry?
One may expect that you should have combinatorial factor. You may have many different.
Exactly, factors. You're absolutely right. You have a combinatorial factor for the number of possible many particle transitions. And so they still may become important. On the other hand, you have an exponential factor in how many of them you do. And so they do become important, in fact, and there are some, at least, simulations by Miguel's group, and they become important. Nevertheless, the conductivity with interaction becomes much smaller than it is without interaction. But you are exactly right, there is a combinatorial factor there.
So do I understand correctly that there is not even a canonical model or caricature in which one can estimate both these exponential factors and the combinatorial factors and some analytic progress?
No, I mean, there is... No, actually, I've been trying to do something similar, but I never got to really getting any result for it. But you're right. There is no such, such theory which can tell you analytically how important it is.
Can I ask two other quick questions? Show this graph of aging. So,
yes.
What is the difference? I mean, can you classify where this stands as opposed to what people call quantum quenches?
Quantum what?
Quantum quenches.
Quantum quenching, I'm afraid I don't know sufficiently well what it is to answer your question. So maybe we can talk about it later, but I also have to go ahead because...
And the other, you know, brief and quick question. You wrote down some expression for W, which
yes.
Of course is a...
transition rate.
Everything is a... the underlying theory is quantum mechanical. But suppose,
yes.
But at the end of the day, this is a probability. So is this a theory of... electron glass, essentially a classical theory whose parameters are to be derived from quantum mechanics. But once you have the parameters, everything is classical.
Well, I think I'll come to that problem. I mean, that is one of the questions, also the Hamiltonian. I mean, there is a little bit of quantum mechanics in that because you have overlaps and includes overlap. So. This is basically a first-order quantum mechanical theory. But the Hamiltonian that is very often used is also classical. And so now the electrons are, of course, very light particles, and so you would expect that quantum effects become very important. Quantum tunneling becomes very important. And so I'll come to that. There is a question of... how well does the model, the usual model that people use, not not exclusively, but very frequently, how does it really apply to a real electron glass where people actually see glassy behavior? So that's one of the open questions, and I'll come to that later a little bit. I think I should let Sweet talk a little bit, but let me just go to the specific, more specific here. This relates to your question. This is an experiment, okay, on an electron glass. And Sweet's experiment, Sweet group's experiment. And you can see that in some cases, the relaxation on a logarithmic scale here is faster at low temperature than at high temperature. And that would be very difficult to explain with a classical model. So in the experiments, there are definite hints that quantum effects are important. Okay. Specifically, let me add to this list of what is slowing down the electron, the element of quantum friction, and that is a possible mechanism that was brought up as a possibility to slow down the electron further, and I don't know if Zvi will address that with his experiments or not. But let me now show specifically the slow relaxation in an electron glass. So here you see that the relaxation goes over more than 10 to the 5 orders of magnitude logarithmically It's a very, very good logarithmic dependence, okay? The aging is also very interesting, and so the aging in an electron glass, you see here the dependence on TW, but if you plot it now, not as T, but as T over TW, everything collapses on itself. Okay, so that is what is called simple aging or sometimes full aging. And that holds in electron glasses. And so there is another experiment, common experiment, which is the so-called two-dip experiment, where you cool the system like you did before to something like equilibrium, then you suddenly excite it by changing the gate voltage in this particular case, and then you start scanning it every so often over a reasonably large range, which includes the original VG from which you where you tried to reach the equilibrium. And so here you see two things. One is the a dip in the conductivity. What you measure is conductivity. And so here you see a dip at the old VG as a function of time. The times of the scanner progressively later and later and later. And so you see a dip here disappearing gradually at the old gate voltage and the new one forming at the new gate voltage. And so the question, why a dip? And you can explain why a dip because what you do with the scan, as you change the VG, from here you of course excite the electronic system once you make that external change. And since the state of the system can change only very slowly, well, when you excite the system, then the conductivity becomes larger, and simply the simple physical reason is that when you excite the electrons, they see more and more empty spaces, empty sites to go into, so the conductivity becomes larger. That is the simple explanation. But the system cannot change its state very rapidly. That is exactly the point of a glass. And so you see the dip disappearing gradually in the old state, from the old state that it was in. And if you look at the way it does it, you see again exactly the logarithmic dependence that you saw in the previous slide. And then naturally at the new gate voltage, it will build up as the system tries to reach the new equilibrium state appropriate to the new gate voltage. But the next thing that you will hear is from Zvi about the dip. Yeah. So let's see. Yeah, take it out and put in yours. Right, I'll find yours in a second. See?
Okay. Yeah. What I'm trying.
This is yours.
No, this is not the beginning.
Not the beginning? Well, don't go to the beginning.
Five? Where is it? Five.
Okay. Five. Well, you're doing it.
Is that the beginning?
You should hope so.
So now you have to put it.
Okay,
yeah, you have it all right.
Okay, so what I will try to do is I understand that some of you are not at all aware of what is this experiment that Mike was describing. I'm going to use that as a way to put down on the table what I think is the most important question that is getting. There are more than questions. There are more than only one question in this game, but I don't have time to.
Okay.
maybe it's better, no? Okay, so in order for me to explain the question, I have to tell you a little bit about what is the actual experiment that is done, because this is the only experiment I'm going to use throughout that presentation. So this is a field effect measurement, and basically this is just a three-terminal device where you have a sample that the conductance you measure is a function of the voltage that you put between it and the nearby equipotential object that you call a gate. This is a MOSFET configuration. And the main reason why I want to say that and explain it is that there are some people who don't even know what it is. But the more danger is with those people that believe they do, because they come from usually semiconductors. And in this case, what happens is that there is a huge change of the conductance when you change the gate voltage. Because basically what this experiment is about is that you put more particles, more charge to your system, or you deplete it of charge, and therefore you modulate the conductance. In a semiconductor, it's a huge effect because the number of charge that you may put with the gate in and out of the sample is very large in comparison with the number of charges that exist there anyhow. And in this experiment that we are talking about, this is extremely small change. You don't change the number of carriers with the gate. This is a negligible change in most cases. So basically, as I said, this is the field effect experiment, and what happens in, when you use it on a degenerate Fermi system, you just modify the position of the Fermi energy, and if it's the density of states as a function of energy, and the Fermi energy happens to sit at a particular place, what you get is a change of the conductance that can be described with the Einstein relation. And in the case that I just show you here, this will give rise to a fairly linear change of the conductance, very small, because as I said, usually the change of the gate voltage and the change of the number of carriers that you affect in the process is very small. So basically what you see here is just a derivative, essentially the derivative of the density of states as a function of energy. There is a particular reason why...
But this is not density. I mean, this step function is not...
It's not a step function. This is just the density of states as a function.
But you have here some step function, which I don't understand.
Where do you see the step function? This?
No, there is some vertical line.
Well, vertical line is just a position of the Fermi energy. That's it. Nothing more. Okay? So this is all how it should behave in theory, and this is going to be the result of an actual experiment. This is 4 degrees, okay, and this is a field effect measurement. You see the change that I told you about, and this sample has a resistance of 40 kilo ohms. This result of a linear part is typical of this resistance, and all resistances that are smaller than that. Maybe this is more or less metallic behavior. Just a reflection of the fact that there is a certain change of the density of states near the Fermi energy as a function of energy, and the slope will reflect that. That's all there is to it. However, when you push the disorder slightly further than that, namely you enter into resistances which are small, the conductance is smaller or much smaller than the quantum conductance, then you suddenly see another feature that comes in, okay? And this is a series of samples. Actually, this is the same physical sample where we keep changing the disorder, which is reflected by the resistance, okay? And then when you do this scan of the gate voltage, what you see is that appearance of a minimum around that zero gate voltage. And the minimum becomes more and more prominent as the disorder increases. But the point is that look at the values of the resistances. It's typically much larger than this value. Only then, if it is not, like in this case, the effect is very small. And by the way, the same that you may get if you, instead of changing the disorder at a given temperature, you fix the disorder and you change the temperature, then if the resistance of the sample happens to be small, you see nothing. And upon cooling, the resistance increases because it's a Navier-Stokes insulator, it's an exponential dependence. Resistance becomes larger and larger very quickly, and so this minimum that appears in the conductance in the field effect measurement becomes more and more prominent. Okay? Let me make a general remark. I know that it's difficult to keep track of what I'm showing you, especially that you're not used to this kind of experiments yourself. Don't pay attention to that. It's just an excuse for me present the question that I have in mind, let me immediately tell you what it is. This is that feature here that you see.
What you're showing here are that temperature effects and gate voltage effects are sort of quote unquote similar in the strongly disordered case. Is very different when you go to the conducting the.
This is what you see here.
You should see some small thing, which would be the.
Why? You don't. There is no thing.
You will not see the.
All mature animals?
Yes.
Let's not jump ahead. But I show you the result. Nothing. Okay? There is nothing here. There is nothing. Okay, maybe I should go back to the first slide, okay? Look, what you see here is not the single particle dose, it's the thermodynamic dose.
Fine. So,
field effect measurement is usually a thermodynamic measurement. It's a way, it's very similar to the Hall effect, and it measures the thermodynamic density of states. That's going to be part of the question. We'll go back to that. You are well motivated. Okay, so this is just to show you that there is a threshold for this behavior. You do not see anything strange until you come deep into the insulating regime, no matter whether it is by temperature or by disorder. And that is where you see this glassy effect. This is why I want to stress on the, to stress to you that this feature is important. And I'm going to try to tell you why in the next few slides. This is the most important single feature of the electron blast. Let me just finish there. We can do experiments without the gate, and we do a lot of experiments without the gate altogether. We can excite the system in many different ways. The electronic system, it talks many languages. You can excite it by light, by microwave, by high electric fields, by magnetic, whatever. But this, when you see this, you know that you will see electron glass effects. When you don't see that, you don't. Okay? So that is by far the most important feature. And what I'm going to do in the next few slides is to show you that this feature has universality that you have not seen in any other system, at least I'm not familiar with any other system that shows this degree of fantastic universality and systematics that by itself screams out to be answered. And this feature, the only thing that we understand about it, and even that is empirical, is that why it occurs at zero gate voltage. What is special about zero gate voltage?
This was the question.
Okay. You have seen in the, if you listen carefully to what Mike was presented before, he showed you this feature appear in a different voltage. The only thing which is special about it is that the sample was equilibrated without changing the gate voltage, at zero gate voltage. If you equilibrate the sample at another gate voltage, that feature will appear there. And in this regard, it is very close to what you have in mind, namely that there is a Fermi edge singularity and that attaches itself to the would-be chemical potential. So it does not depend on any particular gate voltage. It could only appear where the gate voltage was allowed to stay there for such amount of time that the system at least partially equilibrated. Okay? So let me start by telling you a little bit about these properties, why it's so interesting and universal. So the first thing is to show you that it is indeed a non-equilibrium effect. So here's a bunch of curves where the same sample and the scan rate was changed between a few seconds in the upper curve and 3 days in the lower one. And you see that there are, that the magnitude of the effect changes with the sweep rate, okay? Eventually, when you do it slow enough, there is nothing. You only get, in all of them, you have this asymmetric part, which is just the normal or the thermodynamic field effect. Superimposed on that, you have this signature that, as I said, changes, the magnitude of it changes with the sweep rate, okay? But if you just remove that part and you just concentrate on the symmetric part, which is what we call the memory dip, and I will explain why later, okay? Then by just scaling the y-axis, namely the magnitude, you can bring that in complete coalescence. So the shape is independent of the sweep rate. Magnitude is, okay, but the shape is not. It's the same shape. I don't change anything else, just the magnitude. Just multiply that by a constant factor. Then let me show you quickly three different samples. This is indium oxide, this is beryllium, this is granular aluminum. All of them are strongly localized. All of them show this memory dip. The only difference you see is in the normal field effect. Here it is negative in beryllium, here it is positive, here it is flat. As I explained to you before, that's the normal thing. That's what happens in indium oxide, that the Fermi energy sits in a position where the Fermi density of states increases with energy. In beryllium, for some reason, the band structure reason, it goes down with energy. Here it doesn't change with energy. Okay. So the first thing that I want you to remember, that the shape does not depend on the sweep rate. It's not a function of the measurement. It is something that belongs to the sample. Okay. Then we can change it in solder, as I showed you before. You may not remember that, but at a given temperature, the magnitude increases with the disorder, okay? But the shape does not. There are two different resistances here and here, different by quite a bit, and by, you know, just shrinking or expanding the y-axis, you can bring that into complete coalescence. So the disorder does not change the shape. Shape is independent of disorder, it's independent of the sweep rate. Okay, then, upon cooling the sample first, low temperature.
The previous graph, it felt as if there was some sort of cusp, but here it's rounded off. Is it meaningful?
That's it's because the temperature, well, maybe not small enough, you're right. I mean, as I know the temperature, the cusp will become more cuspy. We'll talk about it in the end, time will allow. But for now, let us concentrate on one temperature, 4 degrees. So now it's 4 degrees, I just cool the sample down and quickly take a sweep. What I see is this black curve, which barely shows anything. You know, it shows already something because you cannot do the sweep quickly enough. But then you let the sample relax at 0 gate voltage, and after a while, okay, an hour or so, you take another sweep, this will be the blue, and after that you take another one and so on. Until 153,000 seconds, this will be the red. What you see here is very interesting, that magnitude increases as a function of time. That, by the way, is nothing else but the log relaxation that Mike was showing you before. If you just stay here and measure the conductance as a function of time, it goes down logarithmically. That's what it is. But it shows you something else, that there is a certain range of energy, because this is can be translated into energy. I can tell you how if you want, and where this business takes place. This is a certain energy range. But the other thing is that when I do the same thing that I did before, namely remove this anti-symmetric part and scale what is remains, I can make that into a perfect coincidence, which means that the shape is time independent. It does not change with time. Magnitude changes, not the shape. It doesn't change with sweep rate, it doesn't change with time, it doesn't change with the disorder. Then, I'm not going to spend any time on that, it's rather complicated, but let me just say that both in Grenoble we were using 20 Tesla, and then later in Tallahassee, up to 30 Tesla, the shape does not change with all this magnetic field. Conductance may change, shape does not change. Okay? So, let me tell you why it is a memory, very briefly, why it is a memory, why we call it a memory gate. Okay, so, you know, this I took from the internet. I mean, it happens that this device actually can be even bought today. I don't know how many of you saw the movie. I myself didn't have the guts to see the full film, but I saw part of that. And that device has been used, I understand, to wipe out memory of people. And you can get it on the internet now used for a price of $300. But in our case, we use a much cheaper device. It's just a small light-emitting diode in the infrared that may cost like about 40 cents or something like that, if you buy it in quantities. And that can be used to completely wipe out, you know, suppose that you already have a well-developed memory tip, what we call, You just expose it to strong enough infrared for a few seconds, and you wipe out the memory altogether. Well, what I mean by that, you end up with nothing. The sample is already at low temperature, and you can kill completely this deep, as you can see this experiment, and you can even do another experiment to show that it's not a temperature effect. This is a real effect, which is interesting by itself. Once you do that, or you kill the memory, here in a different way, by putting a large enough source to drain voltage, namely non-ohmic field, you can also wipe out this memory, and once you do that, you start from a fresh sample. It doesn't have any more aging, which is a sort of a memory, and that is why we call it a memory. So that brings me to the first question that I have is, you know, given all this, interesting thing, namely that this is actually a signature of the glass. If you have that, you have glass. You don't have that, you don't have the glass. You have no memory, you have nothing, you're aging. What is it? Okay? And let me now come to the remark that Yuval made, or the question that how come, is it something that actually reflects some density of states as a function of energy? Because the thermodynamic measurement that is involved, okay, indeed measures modulation of energy. It may measure that. This is a very small scale in terms of energy that I'm looking here. This would be like typically a few millivolts in the best case. It's a very small energy scale, okay? So do I have such a modulation of the density of state? What kind of density of states is it? Okay, if it were a thermodynamic measurement, then I don't expect it to disappear when I do the sweep rate slow. So it is not a thermodynamic measurement. So what kind of a density of states is there, if there is a density of states? What I can tell you after, you know, agonizing all these questions for several years, I came to the conclusion that it has to be, you know, something that is sort of schizophrenic. It has to be both thermodynamic and both single particle density of states. Because if I, for some aspects of it, if I assume it is a Coulomb gap, a single particle dose, I can understand a lot of the effects. On the other hand, I don't understand others. But then if I assume it's some thermodynamic modulation, I can understand some of it and don't understand the other part. So I need to find some other definition, some other theoretical construct that would fill the bill, okay? But let me tell you what we do know. We do know something about that, and this is the part which is most interesting. What we do know, what I showed you so far, that this feature is only a property of the sample. It does not change with anything. But it does change with something. The shape does change with one thing, and one thing only. And that is the density of carriers. Only that. Now, this is an example that was done with amorphous indium oxide, which so far is the only system where you can change, without changing the system, change dramatically or appreciably the carrier concentration over appreciable range, what you see here. And that is reflected in the width, typical width of this memory beam. Okay? In fact, in this case, you see something so enticing that it screams out, you know, it looks like a BCS density of a single particle dose, because it developed this this feature here, which others do not show. This happens at the low end of this series of samples. So it does change with that. And that brings me actually to
if you look at the shape as you approach the minimum, does that change?
The shape as you approach?
The minimum. I mean, if that's your power law.
You mean here?
Power law.
You mean here?
Yeah, I mean, I know that one's rounded.
No, it's rounded if you are at a relatively high temperature. If you go to low, it becomes more sharp.
Right, so if you're in the low temperature limit, is that power law always the same?
What power law? You mean this part? How does that? We don't know.
Asymptotic.
You can fit it to a power law. Other people try to fit it to a Lorentzian. So we don't know what it is. If we don't know what it is, we don't have anything to say about it. That's the problem. What is it? That's the most important single feature, and we don't know what it is. What I'm trying now to do is to show you that there is enough reason to work hard to find out what is it.
Okay. But if you fit into a problem, what is the problem?
Well, it's not a problem. It's not a problem because, well, let me tell you something at the end. Let me just go through the list and tell you why it is interesting. Those are the systems that so far show what we call intrinsic electron glass effect as opposed to extrinsic. All those systems show that, and in particular, all of them show the memory, which is the most important signature. If you don't have that, then I don't believe it is intrinsic. Now, I think it's interesting to look at them and find out in what way, what is common to them, you know? What is common to them? So let's go through the list. I mean, what about, for instance, structure? There are people like Misha that believe that everything has to do with defect. It cannot be electronic, you know? Electron is a very light mass. As opposed to, you know, an atom, it's four orders of magnitude difference. And everything that a photon is in the exponent, you know, four orders of magnitude in the exponent is a big deal. Now, of course, it is slightly compensated, but what Mike has said, that, you know, that the distances that the electron can hop is much larger, but that still leaves two orders of magnitude in the exponent, and I don't think that that's something easy to shove aside. And this is what Misha probably has in mind, and I share his view about that. But nevertheless, let's look at what may be common to those systems. So structurally, they're all different. This is polycrystalline, this is amorphous. This is granular. This is polycrystalline again. So you cannot say that there is anything common about that. Now, in terms of underlying, you know, other kind of order, like superconductivity. So this one may be superconducting at some range of parameter. This one is not. This one is. This one is. This one is. This one is not. This one certainly not. On the other hand, this one is magnetic, but neither is there any of the other ones. There are oxides possibly in this and that. Certainly this one is also made with oxide, so you may think that maybe, we have oxygen or oxide in some form that plays a role here. Unfortunately, for that point of view, is that gold and nickel, both of them were created under ultra high vacuum conditions in situ quench cooling process. No way that there is any oxygen there. So there is nothing coming about it. There is only one thing coming to them on top of that thing that all of them show Hopkin conductivity of some form. But that is also obeyed by semiconductors. And there is no indium arsenide, no gallium arsenide, no silicon, nothing of that. So what is different, what is common to all those samples and not shared by a semiconductor? I don't see any reason why a semiconductor, if I take that typical width of the memory that I showed, and I extrapolate this dependence to something which would be comparable to what you can achieve with a semiconductor, then it is going to be a smaller value, but not small enough that we can measure it. I think it should be possible to measure. So why don't we see this effect in semiconductors? This is the other part which bothers Misha, because he's a semiconductor person. And if it's not shown by semiconductor, then that must be judged. Okay? So I tell you what empirically could be the reason, at least consistent with that, is that in association with this dependence, there is also how fast is the relaxation. And for some reason that still has to be understood, below a certain value of the density, the relaxation becomes extremely fast. Now, if you extrapolate that to semiconductors along this line, then we know that we cannot measure that. Okay, so at least that is the thing that
you're saying that if you map it on a semiconductor, then the
nobody was able to see memory deep in a semiconductor. People reported.
So you're saying that two-dimensional electron gas will relax very fast? This is what
I'm saying that if this is generic, okay, then if you have a system with low density of carriers, then the relaxation would be fast and you won't be able to see them. Okay? Unless you go to such low temperatures where the Hopping length is enormous, in which case you won't be able to measure the conductance in my point of view. Okay? So I'm saying that there is a reason why it goes down so fast, which again puts puts the emphasis on this question, what is special about N? Yuval, listen. What I should have said, all those systems have high density, and all of them follow this rule, that the larger the density of carriers, the bigger is the memory beam. So in the first place, all those systems that show electron glass effects, what we call intrinsic, there is some intimate connection between an electronic property, namely carrier concentration, and the feature that is the alpha and zeta of the effect, namely the memory beam. All of them. So that must be electronic. Whatever you do, there is no way that you'll be able to describe it in any other way. And on top of that, there seems to be also a correlation that this is maybe a mild effect, this dependence of the typical width on density is, you know, a sort of algebraic. Here it is something dramatic, like a phase transition. So the density somehow plays a role that we need to understand. Well, that's typical relaxation time. Typical because, you know, this is something that some years ago, you may not remember, you actually asked me the question, maybe you asked me that again. If it's a logarithmic dependence, there is no way to define uniquely a timescale, okay? So that's an arbitrary definition, but at least it's consistent. We use the same definition. Yeah.
Does that curve
tell what was ambient? That we don't know. These experiments, as experimentalists here can tell you, are never too easy. They take a lot of time. And what you see here is probably, like, you know, a result of what I put together in this short presentation is probably like 20 different papers over a period of more or less 20 years. Yes.
What can you say about the localization length? Because
okay, wait a second. First, let me just.
And it should be
let me remind you. I came here not to give answer. This is not a talk. You know, each one of those needs more explanation. I came here in order to present these questions for you because we have been struggling with these two questions for many years, and we couldn't get to the first base with it. You know. So again, the question, what is this memory beam? What kind of a density of state module? Is it the density of states? You know, I offered for to the consideration of some people something like a non-equilibrium thermodynamic density of states, something like that. I don't know what to say, because as I told you, you cannot go with thermodynamics and you cannot go with non-equilibrium. It is not a single particle dose, because single particle dose cannot be related directly to the conductance, okay? And it cannot be the thermodynamic one because the measurement is a it's a non-equilibrium effect for, as I demonstrated. So this, we need a new theoretical concept for non-equilibrium situation. I think it's extremely important, and as I was trying to show you, this feature is universal. It does not depend on anything. It's amazing. You know, superconductivity, you have a similar feature, which is a single particle dose, but is affected by disorder, it's affected by magnetic impurities, it's affected by... Here, they control by one parameter and one parameter only. It does not depend on anything. It does not depend on disorder. It does not depend on the localization length. It does not. In the granular system, they make resistances between, say, a few kilo ohms and few giga ohms. Obviously, the grain size changes in the process, and yet the width of the memory dip is exactly the same. So it's only the material that makes that. Isn't that universal enough? Have you heard about something more universal than that? Please tell me. I'm done, by the way. You know,
yeah,
we have done anyhow, right?
I can't continue. I should be continued.
You're supposed to come with an answer. Only then you can clap. You know, answer, you cannot.